Today we're covering the Bible study on the book of James, chapter 4. And we've tried a couple other approaches. We've gone through the Bible lecture and going through each verse and methodically going through. And it seems like it's taken now, almost a year? And we've gotten through three chapters. And some of it's heavier than other parts. So I'm going to try something a little bit. I'm going to get into the sports car mode here and go drive a little faster at this point. I'm really going to cover we're going to go over the book of chapter 4 in the book of James, and then I want to cover two particular subjects, and then we're going to go into the question and answer session. So let's take a look at chapter 4 in the book of James. I'm reading from the New King James Version. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you do not ask. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever, therefore, wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously? But he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Verse 7, therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Verse 8, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. He will lift you up. Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another? Verse 13, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. So this is really quite a chapter. It covers a lot of material. And if we were to really go in depth, we would be able to take each verse or perhaps half verse, and each one of them would be a sermon of itself. We could if we went into that. But I want to cover a couple of themes that this is looking at in here. And one theme is the concept of pride. Now, this word pride in here, because it rises up when we're talking about arrogance. The word pride itself, which is in some translations, did not come into use into the 12 or 1300s in the English language. So it's a relatively new word in the King James Version of the Bible where it was included. And so what we look at is, well, what was the original intent or original meaning of this concept when it says, you know, who are you? You know, are you the boastful one? It's really, we're looking at the concept of arrogance. And so when we read this, here, and we're talking about the humble. It doesn't, in fact, I pulled up the definition of pride from Merriam-Webster. And Merriam-Webster's got six different definitions of the word pride. Now, this is a common and popular American dictionary for the last couple hundred years. The state or quality of being proud. Well, then, but what exactly what is proud? And it goes on and it gives some options. It says one of them is conceit. Another one would be a reasonable or justifiable self-respect. And then there's delight or elation arising from an act or a possession or a relationship, such as parental pride. So it's a quality or state of being proud. The second concept of proud is it's proud or disdainful behavior or treatment. You could substitute the word disdain. If someone is prideful, they may be disdaining something, for example. Another one is an ostentatious display, meaning, and perhaps we've seen some of these things where somebody who is prideful is wearing something that makes them, what they're wearing makes it cry out, look at me, kind of thing. I know I've seen people dressed like a colorful chicken, and I'm sure you have too. And I think of the word ostentatious. And then, of course, there's the definition of pride. It's referring to the source of the pride, such as the best of a group or in a class or something like that. In other words, these are very functional definitions. Pride could also be a company of lions. Do you see lions running in fear? No, they're just walking boldly along, and wherever they are, everybody else seems to run in fear. So they call it a pride of lions or group. Then there's a definition of showy or impressive group. And a showy or impressive group could be used, for example, a pride of dancers. Now, I hadn't heard that one before I read this, but it makes sense. They're out there proud and they're displaying or doing it. And of course, I spend time at an art school and they've got a lot of dancers that are very, very well trained, very bold. Examples of pride in a sentence. And so all of these are not talking about conceit. But some of these would be referring to a justifiable or reasonable self-respect or just the delight or elation at having accomplished something. So the use of the term, it covers many things when we use the modern term of pride instead of just, so when we read one word in the Bible where it may use pride or proud, we must understand that that's not the original word that was used. We have to look for the meaning that's deep. And that's when we would stumble, or we would look into, and we would find the difference. We would look for example, and note the difference between the concept of vanity versus pride. We can have pride in our work, but it becomes sin if we become vain about it. So it's really going overboard. It's going too much. So when we look here in James 4, I want us to understand there's a variety of definitions for a number of these words. And pride would be one of them. because it's certainly no sin to have a good feeling, have good self-esteem, based on something that's well done. There's no sin in that. And so that you really wouldn't call vanity. But if you look at it insofar as the attitude of the heart is, look what I did and you can't. Now we've gone past the part of appropriate esteem, and you're putting something negative on someone else by comparison. So a person, and even according to Merriam-Webster, a person may be proud without being vain. That pride relates more to our opinion of ourselves, and vanity was what we would have others think of us. I thought it was interesting that even a very much a secular approach to the definition of pride would look at it that way. The other concept I want to take a look at is the concept that we see here, and we'll find the in verse 4. Before I get to that concept, I do want to note when it says adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know your friendship with the world is enmity with God? We're going to look at friendship with the world in a moment. But in looking over a number of commentaries, they said the first two words, adulterers and adulteresses, may have been added somewhere along the line, that the original scripts may just say adulteresses. And that really brings us to that we are really the bride of Christ. And so therefore, if we are an adulteress, we're wandering away from the worship of God. And apparently somebody thought, well, we have to be gender equal here of some sort. So they put adulterer and adulteress to designate both genders. But really it's a spiritual situation here in this verse. So if we look at it that way, is it that we are the bride, and we should not wander away from our relationship with God. So that brings us into verse 4. And verse 4 is, adulterers and adulteresses, or adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Well, this is somewhat an odd expression, because a friend of the world, because we have these, because if you look up and you do some examples of the biblical examples of the word world, you come up with all kinds of biblical uses of this term. I know once in a while when I'm really tired and my wife will ask me a question, and you know, sometimes it's, I don't say the sun and the moon and the stars line up, that would be pagan, but sometimes the conditions are right. And for some reason, I just kind of explode forth on a particular subject, and she must have asked this particular question. Now, it's always dangerous to answer a question when my wife asks it, because she writes things down. And as a former professional transcriptionist, she catches everything. And I told her about this subject, and she says, "Oh, you've had a rant on that." Oh, I have? Oh, yes. Here, I'll print it out for you. So there's 8 pages of single-spaced rant on this entire subject that has a lot of books, chapters, and verses in it that apparently I would really let loose at some point. That's remarkably, I was surprised that I did that without notes, but apparently I went off on this whole concept of what is the world. And we'll explore that in depth when we have an opportunity to do that. But I just called to your mind that when God created the heavens and the earth, and he created all of these things, what did God say about the world? It was good. And so we have this concept, and well, and then we go to John 3:16, and most of us have memorized the verse. Most people with who accept Christianity will know John 3:16. For God loved what? So God so loved the world that he gave the ultimate sacrifice, which is his son. So this is a bit of a contest in the mind. Now, well, here, if you want to be a friend of the world, then you make yourself an enemy of God. Well, we have this little complexity. How can that be? If God said it's good, and and God set the example by so loving the world, and yet if we're a friend of the world by this verse here, well, then we're alienating ourselves from God. So there's something that we're not understanding. So that means we should probably look at what is the Bible talking about when it uses that term world. And of course, we can all look it up, and there's interesting places that we can look it up. If we take a look at Strong's is one of the places, and look at all these different definitions of when they come up with world, so that we don't get wandering off in the wrong direction. And so there is an outline of, what is it, just a list of things that when we refer to the world, indeed it could be the world or the universe, you know, just what we think of, or it could be referring to the circle of the earth, the image of the earth. It could be an ornament, decoration, or adornment, such as the arrangement of the stars or the heavenly hosts as the ornament of the heavens. That's in 1 Peter 3:3. So you have this whole arrangement. And I suppose if you were an astronaut and you would look back, you would see everything all laid out accordingly. Then another definition is referring to the inhabitants of the earth, in other words, the human family. So when you think of the world, well, there's the humans. Well, God made those too, and he said those were good, and some of them weren't so good, as it proved out to be later. And then we come to the definition of worldly affairs, the aggregate of things worldly, or things earthly. And then it subdivides this down into the whole circle of earthly goods, endowments or riches, advantages and pleasures, which, although hollow and frail and fleeting, stir desire, and interestingly enough, and they say seduce from God, in other words, draw us away from God, and are obstacles to the cause of Christ. This is right out of Strong's. And so when we take a look at this, well, now which definition should we be using here? And it's all of a sudden when you realize there's all these different definitions, and we take a look at that friendship with the world is enmity with God. It's not logical or rational that it means this chunk of soil and rock and atmosphere that God created and said it was good with all of the flora and the fauna on it, all the animals there. So it really boils it down to, and the inhabitants of the earth, well, they're all potential members of God's family, so we're not to condemn them. So that's out. I mean, it's because they all have hope, and indeed, that's the entire Holy Day cycle is set up to demonstrate the hope for mankind and the whole hope of salvation through Christ. So we really boil it down to what is the world in this sense, that someone who's a friend of the world, and that is a friend, and we could say it this way, a friend of the things that draw us away from God, that seduce from God, that are obstacles to the plan of God. And what are those things? And so that's where we get to the other verses about coveting and idolatry, things that draw us away, things that people do that are at odds with what God wants us to do. The Greek word here is kosmos. It means, the root word, komeo, means to take care of. But it could also mean order or arrangement. I guess the Greeks, we've seen the Greek word kosmos. It means just everything, you know, the creation of everything. So we have this... This there's another Greek word, which O-I-K-E-O, which means to dwell. Isn't there a yogurt with that name? I don't know, something like that. Yeah, it's very close to that, which means to dwell. In the New Testament, it means human inhabitants of the world. And so there are lots of different uses, and I've got, I mean, single space, I've got three pages of all these different uses of the terms for world and so forth. And rather than slug through all of those, I just wanted to call attention in this particular verse that what's really referring to here is who wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Is if you're going to be a friend of the things that alienate yourself and people from God, then you're the one that's alienating yourself from God. So when we go then down to a couple of verses more, when it says God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble, so resisting the proud, does that mean resisting the person who is pleased because they won the race and they did well? No, we have to remember the meanings of the terms are very critical. So resisting the proud means, in this case, the arrogant, the one who's gone over the top, who is calling attention to something to appear in a particular way in front of others, but gives grace to the humble. So when we look at these words, and I just would like just to emphasize that the theme here is about the society that in which we live, the world that pulls us away from God. And so just understanding the definition of world here, and then understanding the concept of the difference between proud and humble, meaning the difference between arrogant and quietly accepting and obedience to God, which is humble. And that brings to mind, of course, Micah 6:8. What does God require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and then what? To walk humbly with your God. But we're looking at it right here, that God resists the arrogant but gives grace to the humble. That's something that's extraordinarily valuable to him. A couple other things that I have in my notes here, that it down, we go down in verse 11, don't speak evil of one another. Notice it doesn't say don't speak things that are uncomfortable to someone else. I guess we would all have to be quiet most of the time because somebody would be uncomfortable about something. But evil, what's evil? Again, it's what's contrary to God. Just pointing out the truth, it might not always be wise. Sometimes it's better to not say something. But if we point out the truth and the truth is uncomfortable, sometimes that's really the way it is. So that doesn't necessarily mean speaking evil of someone. And then this continuing on in verse 11, speaking evil of a brother and judging his brother speaks evil of the law. When we look at the word judge, we can think of the word condemn. It's not our job to condemn the salvation of someone else. And you may know, and I've known people where they were quite willing to condemn others to an unsatisfactory ending. That's not what we're about. That doesn't mean what they did was right. And that doesn't mean that we can't condemn an action, but not we really shouldn't a person. So that speaking, we must be careful. Particularly here is notice it says of a brother. In other words, one who is a fellow believer in God and the path that God has chosen for us all. Because if they're trying to do their best, and then you're condemning them for doing their best, despite their stumbles, then that calls you, or it calls ourselves into judgment before God. Because then we become doers, and in other places they will refer to those people as busybodies, getting into the affairs of others, and easy to condemn. And so just like we heard today in this sermon, which I thought flowed well for James 4, is that who's the responsible party here? And people that walk by, claiming a higher level of responsibility, walk by, but they were judging the law, but they weren't a doer of the law. So all of the people that walk by, yet the Samaritan wasn't doing the condemnation. He was actually the doer. And that's really the only comments I wanted to make on James 4, but I did have a bunch of questions that I wanted to pass out. So I want to go over some of those, and I'm just going to read those into the record, and then if Mr. Jackson, you would hand those out. Because James 4, if we take a look, how do we approach these questions? What do families and friends commonly fight about? I know most of you have probably never had a family or friend fight, so you'll have to use this in your imagination as to what other families or friends do. But you all have good, fertile minds. I'm sure you can come up with something. Number two, why doesn't God give some people what they ask for? And we can refer to James 4 and verse 3, or Isaiah 55:89, 2 Peter 3:8, Philippians 4, verses 6 and 7, or John 15, verse 7. Question number three, what can we do this week to bring more humility into our lives? And I'll tell you how I'd like to organize here in just a moment. Number four, have you ever asked for something and not received it? Do you think the motives behind some of your requests may have been the reason God did not grant your request? Number five, there are basically two types of categories of sin, sins of commission, things that we do wrong, and sins of omission, things that we should do but don't. So which one do we struggle with more? And number six, in what ways are we friends of the world? And number seven, how do you resist the devil? So if we can take a few minutes, and it's just an idea. Let's see, we have several people. If we can be in groups of three, at most four. And I'm wondering if, I don't know, what's a good way to do this? Now, if I were in a school classroom, I would hand out a deck of cards and say, everybody who's got hearts are over here. Everybody has diamonds over there, and everybody has spades over here and clubs over there. So, we can count off. We can do that. If you can just give me a number, right? And then start with one. Two. Three. One. Two. Three. And one. Okay. So if we can give it a few minutes, if you can get into the appropriate groups. Who's ever got a one, stand up and get together, and the twos get together, and the threes get together. So let's take a look on James 4, the discussion questions. It's easy to go in numerical order. What do families and friends commonly fight about? Group number one.
Money, loyalties, kids, interests, and food.
Why, this is a short list. Oh, vacations. Kind of reminds me of the story of people spent as much time planning their family life as they did their vacations. Their vacations would be a lot happier. That was group two. Where are we on group two? What do family and friends commonly fight about?
We have religion, politics, and money.
Money. Generally, I figured you have to have money to argue about it, but... They say that things that you should never bring up at the Thanksgiving dinner are politics, sex, and religion. I'm not sure. I think any one of them is a bombshell when you roll it into the room and pull the pin on a grenade there. Okay, group three, what did you come up with?
Same,
which is?
Money, religion, politics.
Money, religion, and politics. So you for them or against them? That's what Calvin Coolidge was, a man of very few words. You know, a young reporter ran up to him and said, Mr. Coolidge, I have a bet with another reporter that I can get you to say more than two words. The president turns to him and said, you lose. Calvin Coolidge then had gone to church, and he came home, and his wife asked him what the sermon was about. And he said, sin. She said, well, what about sin? He goes, he's agin it. So we have a bunch of Coolidges here. We're getting these short answers down. Okay, group one. Number question two. Why doesn't God give some people what they ask for? Why doesn't God give some people what they ask for?
Because your heart's not right when you ask for it.
You ask, according to James, if you ask because you ask amiss. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, if your heart isn't into the...
So that's you're following up on
timing
that.
Timing wasn't right and not good for someone else because you wanted to.
It might be the right thing, but the wrong time.
And then it's not good for someone else. You're wanting something better for them, and you're wanting it, not him.
That's very good, yes. We ask for others what we ourselves wish for. I think that's the explanation for a lot of Christmas presents, isn't it? Group number two. Why doesn't God give some people what they ask for?
Could just be that they're not humble enough. They just think they deserve it. And God's not going to give you something if you're not really repentant or... You don't need it, maybe. You know, like a new car or new house.
I can give you a lot of reasons why. Yes. Car, house, anything else?
$1 million would hurt.
Okay. Mustang?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That would be good.
69
Mustang.
4.8.
Okay. Okay, why doesn't God give some people what they ask for? Group three.
Well, Jesus asked for the cup to be passed for him, and God said no, because that was not the answer for the time.
So timing has a lot to do with it. We hear it in each of the groups that, we understand how you feel, but maybe it's not what's best for everyone else, or maybe it's not best for you at this time. So there could be a number of reasons why we don't get it, other than, and we may not even know we're asking amiss. When I asked for a wife, I said, it has to be good for her, or it isn't going to be good for me. You know the little thing you put on the refrigerator that says, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, kind of thing? So really, that's the case where it really has to work well for someone else, as well as oneself. Question number three, what can we do this week to bring more humility into our lives? Group one.
Well, I'll go then. Okay. To add for, ask God for humility, pray, ask for that. And as Mary Jo said, be kind, especially work on being kind. Be a good listener was a good answer, I thought. And don't respond in kind to people. Give people the benefit of the doubt. And give deference to others. Don't respond in kind to rude people.
So that's all really easy to do, right? No? No? You mean we have to actually work at those things? Okay. Thank you, Group 1. Group 2, what can we do this week to bring more humility into our lives?
You ready for this one?
Let me count the ways.
Keep my mouth shut sometimes.
Super glue, duct tape, Velcro. Group three, what can we do this week to bring more humility into our lives?
Prayer, like just praying for, you know, praying to God.
Every minute we spend in prayer is one less minute we have to mess up in some other way. So that's a very good point. Any other anything else on our list here? Okay. Question number four: have you ever asked God for something and not received it? Do you think the motives behind some of your requests may have been the reason that God did not grant your request? This is very personal about you. Go ahead.
Yes. Do I give an example?
Go for it.
Okay. I guess it's pretty personal. I was wanting to adopt Brandon and Peyton when Gene was dying because I knew that Social Security would continue on because he was on disability and I would have them then. And so I was... They would be minors, and therefore I would have an income because my income from him was stopping, and I barely had any. But it wasn't working out. I talked to an attorney, and she said, since the parents are still involved, that you will have to spend a lot of money to be able to adopt them, and it's not going to happen. And so I just said, okay. And I feel like my reason for doing it was that I was so afraid that I was going to end up with kids on the street. And that, I think it was a lack of faith. And when I just accepted that it wasn't going to work. I just didn't fight it anymore. I just said, that's it. That's how it's going to be. And I just knew that God would take care of it. And I just had peace then about it. And so I just feel like it was a lack of faith and on my part. And I think it was going to be bad for them, and it's actually worked out better for them that they had as much of a relationship as they did with their parents, and without me being their adoptive mother, that it actually worked out better for them, and I felt like God worked it out really for the best in the long run.
Yeah, we sometimes have a hard time seeing the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I've been in some really bad situations in my life, and sometimes I pray, get me out of this, get me out of this. And once... particular situation I had, it was God never got me out of it, but it kind of like I had to stand up and get out of myself. I had to do something myself, and once I looked into what I needed to do to get to change the situation, then it seems like God had my back all the way and everything worked out. But it sometimes I think we have to stand up and do some things too. I mean, God doesn't always do everything for us. He does a lot for us, and a lot of times he does save us out of situations, but sometimes we have to have the character to do something ourselves too.
Okay, let's go to group two. Have you ever asked for God for something and not received it? Do you think the motives behind some of your requests may have been the reason that God did not grant your request?
Well, I asked a great request one time back a couple of years ago. I started asking, praying about it. And I had several hundred people, I'm sure, helping me pray for it. When my kidneys quit working, I asked God to help get them operating again. And through a lot of prayer and different things that I did, and God's help especially, my kidneys have started working again, and I have been off of dialysis about 6 months. And I thank God every day for his intervenes.
How changed life is, then, isn't it? Remarkable change. Group three.
Shirley.
It's about like what he said. You know, we prayed a lot for that he would be healed, and he was. And some of the things that I didn't get answers to probably had the wrong intentions. So, anyway. That's about it, I guess.
One of my daughters recently wrote, the advice from her husband was not to pray that we have no troubles in life, because everyone will have troubles, but rather pray that we have the tools, the resources, and the character to stand up to those troubles and to deal with them. And I thought, well, that's... I liked him before. I'm liking him, his son-in-law, even better now. Because it was really a mature way to look at it, because those are going to be common to all those circumstances. How do we deal with them? Question number five for group one. There are basically two categories of sins: sins of omission, the things we do wrong, and sins of commission, and the sins of omission, things that we should do but don't. Which do you struggle with more?
Well, we all agreed that understanding we struggle with them both quite a bit. It's the omission that's the harder for us, the one we struggle with the most, because it's the one that's easiest to ignore, put some other priority over. You just don't take action, right? As opposed to an action of sin where you can kind of control yourself, hopefully. The omission is all you got to do is just not think about it, or something else seems more important, and all of a sudden you're not doing what you should have done. So that's kind of what we came to.
Very good. Group two.
Well, one of the things is we have the TV on, and we know we should probably shut it off because a certain program come on that we shouldn't be watching. We still leave it on to get that little bit of tidbit. We shouldn't be doing that. We should have the backbone to say, enough is enough, shut it off, and go about God's business the way we should.
For group three, omission or commission? Which one is the biggest struggle?
I think it's all been said.
There's a famous quote by a fellow by the name of Harvey Cox, who said, not to decide is to decide. So if you choose to walk on by the poor wretch, and you say, I'm not going to make that decision right now, that was a decision, as we've heard in the sermon today. So not to decide becomes a decision. To avoid an answer is your answer. May not be the answer you wish that everyone would think about, but it is so. Let's go to question number six. In what ways are we friends of the world?
We don't have a group.
Well, yeah, you want to let them go?
Sure,
first?
It sounds like a plan. Thank you for the idea. They're not thanking you, but hey, it's a good idea anyway.
Well, we kind of went back and forth on Friends of the World because you didn't say in ways that would make us enmity of Christ. So, we didn't really come up with a definite answer on that one because of that.
In James, what is it? James 4, what is it? Verse 4 or 5? That becoming friends of the world means things that will seduce us away from God. And how often do we spend with things that we don't even realize it at first, but the eyelashes are fluttering as they pull us in that direction? Kind of scary when it's only later that we realize those things. Friends of the world, question 6.
Oh boy. Yeah. I think somewhere in Galatians it mentions the works of the flesh that just seems like all you have to do is just do nothing and they come natural to a lot of us, speaking for myself. If you don't watch what you're thinking or what you're doing, you know, you're automatically there. With the world, it comes natural to be at enmity with God. It's just the way they, you know, operate. And we're not careful, it's the way we begin operating. Galatians, where is it?
5:21.
The works of the flesh are these.
Yeah, and there's quite a list.
There's a long list.
Verse 19, now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, nudeness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies. Verse 21, envies, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I told you in the time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. Doesn't say those who used to but gave it up. It says those who practice. That's an active current circumstance. So that's a good point. Those are ways to become friends with the world. Let's just go through Galatians 5:19 through 21. It's a good point. Any other group here? Are we? Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, we had compromising to fit in with others. Watching the wrong entertainment, wrong sorts of entertainment. Just we compromise God's laws when we try to fit in with others. And then we think about, you know, okay, I really want to do this with somebody. What is the minimum requirement of the law that I have to obtain so that I can do what I want to do?
How close to the edge can we get? Will our hand actually burn on the burner, or will it just get warm? Yes.
Exactly.
Oh. Why is it we painfully know what you mean? And then let's go to questions. Any more on question 6? Anybody will have anything to add on that one? Let's go to question 7. Group 2. How do you resist the devil?
Well, I mean, prayer, Bible study, and just staying close to God, which sounds so simple, but obviously it's not. I seem to struggle anyway. I don't know, maybe nobody else does, but that's what I've kind of come up with.
Any other, what's the next group on resisting? How do you resist the devil? Question 7.
Pretty much what they said, being close to God and I believe, was it you who said like the devil will flee if you draw near to God.
Yeah. You said the one too about fellowship with others.
Like-minded fellowship. That's a really, that gives you a protective barrier when other people can help reinforce the positives. All alone can be a little tough sometimes. out there. Go ahead.
Oh, we're next? Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, this is what I learned in Al-Anon.
Excuse me. In Al-Anon. You know, they're going to come in and accuse you of everything you want to. You just sit there and you listen. You don't put no action to it or anything. Just listen and give them respect so they can tell you what you are and how you are and you're doing this wrong and everything else, you know. And then turn and just walk away and be silent. That way, they have no way of, ever just listen to them, walk away, don't engage them in a fight or anything.
So there's no comeback.
There's no comeback.
You don't have the gloves on for boxing.
Of course, by your actions, and then be positive in your thinking. And no fear. Go ahead. No fear, no worry. Do what you can. Arguing is my worst thing to quit doing.
Any other comments on question 7? How do you resist?
It's also hard to argue with the devil.
That's an awful thing. Well, he's had more experience at it.
Did we bring up reading our Bibles? Just in other words, putting our head into certain things that the Bible, that the devil doesn't want to be a part of. So reading scriptures, and that may have been said, but I missed it. So in prayer, I think Gabriel brought up that. Yeah.
If we fill our minds and hearts with the right things, it crowds out the other stuff. And that's why it's no use. It reminds me of one of my uncles was in Japan, and on the street corners, they would always approach the obvious Westerner with open coat, want to buy watch or some other product. And he thought, you know, I'm really tired of this because I'm accosted. There's people on every street corner, and he's going to cross the street, and the next street salesman will go halfway across the street and then finish walking back with him and try to sell him in broken English. So he came up to a street corner, and the first guy, you know, want to buy watch, and he looked at him and blinked his eyes and said, "Parlez-vous français?" Meaning, do you speak French? And the Japanese fellow was confused. And so he kept walking across the street. The next guy is coming across the street, salesman, to convince him to buy something. And the first salesman yells back, "It's no use. He doesn't speak English." Well, and so I'm thinking about that. Is that how we treat the devil? Does he say, "It's no use. We're not on that wavelength. We've filled it up with the things that you've suggested on the resistance methods." So when he's coming across the street to convince us, he will say, "It's no use."
I know when I'm not really, you know, really tired or something, I'm, you know, I don't behave as well as I, you know, sometimes I should. So, yeah, just, you know, things like that are helpful.
Only 32% of the nation gets enough sleep.
It's really having an organic strength, meaning an inside strength for yourself. Now you're less susceptible to being misled physically, meaning because you're not in a weakened moment. So you're not caught in a weakened state. And we all have various weakened states depending upon time of day, what we've eaten, how much we've slept, and that sort of thing. One last thing on the resisting the devil. I might have told this one before about the guy that the minister that was preaching in church, and the devil comes in the back door, and he comes up and people are screaming and running in every which direction, except for one old guy sitting off on the side. He just sat there calmly, and the devil scared everybody off and then left off chasing him, scared everybody off, and just the devil and the old man in the room. And he asked, "How come you're not running in fright like everybody else?" He says, "I'm not worried about you. I've been married to your sister for 40 years." So sometimes it's a the temptation or the problem comes in the form of another person. And how well do we see that? It's not just this certain up-in-the-air devil or the horns and the tail and the pitchfork. Is it the people that we relate to or associate with that for which we can have a challenge? Because they might be representing. I'm not talking spouses here, but I'm just saying, is it because we're like-minded? But the world is full of the using of people to bring us or draw us away. So that's really, how do we navigate that? How do we resist them, resist the devil, but still want to have a good relationship with them? Probably one of our biggest challenges is those relationship issues. And that's what we start out with when we look in James. And what does it say? From whence comes wars and fightings from among you? These conflicts, these individual conflicts. And then closing out the chapter with resisting the devil. And I see that as kind of bookends that fit in that other chapter. Any other comments on James chapter 4? Ah. When you do good for others, that's an excellent, I know people, and you know people, because they're often carrying on about their problems and their troubles, and it's all about me. Whereas if they took the time and the effort to make it about someone else and do what they could, the good that they could for others, there isn't as much time to focus on the self and wallow in self. And that's really a huge, huge issue, because the satanic influences often come through those kinds of attitudes of self-pity and so forth. So if we could focus on what good we can do to someone else, that will build them up, and by building them up, builds us up. Excellent, excellent idea. Other comments? Yes, Kathy?
I was just going to say, back on that number 6, kind of the tactic, because it's being a real friend to the world.
Ah, differentiating between a false friend and a real friend.
And a real friend, and that by, you know, setting the right example, even if they don't know now we're setting the right example, when they're resurrected, they're going to say, oh, that's why they were like
that. Sermonette men, you've been advised. That's a good subject for that. Yes, Mr. Jackson. It's a good point. And that's the today's sermon was of the world, or in the world, but not of the world. Are we walking by? Is that our example? Or are we attending to the issues? Reminds me of my girls when the twins went to camp, and they were, 15, 16 years old, and they came away from camp as their first camp, teen camp experience, and they compared it to high school. They said, when you go to camp, you learn the difference between right and wrong and the importance of choosing the right. In high school, they don't know that there's any difference between right and wrong. That's huge. And this is a teenage mindset that was able to differentiate this. But it's not just teenagers. We have a whole world out there that cannot differentiate between that there is a right and a wrong and that you should make a choice. They just see it all together as what it serves me, what is self-serving and what is not. And hence, so we have the results in James 4, verse 1, and then we go to the end of James for the solution, resisting the devil. Any other comments? Then we'll close out this Bible study for James 4.